This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Poles Apart, a Consilio podcast where we look at property planning and politics from across the capital. I'm Nathan Parsad-Wyatt, a former Conservative Party advisor and director at Consilio, and I'm joined today by not our usual Luke Francis, but a very different Luke. Luke Tatton, who's an account director here at Consilio.
Hi everyone, great to be on the podcast and replacing one Luke for another.
Luke for Luke replacement, I think, is what Luke Francis said the other day. But Luke Francis is currently in sunny California for Easter, so we're all pretty jealous of that. But so, Luke, if you're listening on some American highway, hello. But it's not all bad, because it looks like we're going to have some sun coming our way across the Easter weekend, and I can picture it now, as I'm sure you can, Luke. Sun's out, Good Friday marks the official start of rosé season.
Much vaunted rosé season.
Listening to Poles Apart, episode 5 with the whole family, which is all going to be about the City of London.
Yeah, very exciting stuff. So the City of London recently had its local elections, and we're going to be joined by Deputy Policy Chairman of the City of London Corporation shortly to talk us through his vision for the future of the City of London.
And we're looking forward to that. But as always, we like to start the podcast by picking out a couple of stories of the week. And it's interesting that election fever is well and truly in train now, and the Labour Party launched their local election campaign up in Barnet last week. Keir Starmer and Sadiq Khan together, suggesting the Conservatives have abandoned the capital, very much hoping to capitalise on kind of the rising cost of living pressures. But also, I think up in Barnet show how Jeremy Corbyn's leadership is a thing of the past and how maybe the party's moved on from that. But on the cost of living thing, it'll be interesting to see how much traction that gets. As a local issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at a macro level, we can see that capitalising on the cost of living crisis is something that's being paid dividends in the French election for Le Pen. She's very much put it at the focus of her election, and she's now in the presidential runoff with Macron.
Yeah, I mean, it's a global problem. Inflation's running massively, but how it plays out, I mean, I'm not sure saying it's a global problem is of comfort to people domestically who are going to be struggling with their bills. And of course, that's one of the reasons in a place like Wandsworth, Ravi, the leader there, has cut council tax going into the election. So we'll see how that plays out. But I think the London elections are interesting. So last time in 2018, I don't think Labour managed election expectations as well as they could have. There was a lot of speculation that they would take Barnet, Westminster, Wandsworth and even RBKC at the time. But it does feel like this time they're doing a slightly better job at managing those expectations. And I think, you know, going up to Barnet and putting a flag firmly into, you know, a Conservative borough with three Conservative MPs is a sign that Keir Starmer must be feeling pretty confident that he's not, you know, he's looking to make gains.
And is this all an election strategy to manage expectations?
I think it has to be, because last time it really did run away with everybody. It was, you know, Labour are going to win, and anything short of winning all of these boroughs was a massive failure. Mm. And it actually allowed the Conservatives to say after the election, well, because they held on to what they had, it wasn't a complete disaster for them. Whereas I think this time Labour are doing a better job at saying, look, it's a long shot, but we're going to give it a go. And we'll see what happens. We won't have too much longer to wait. And postal votes have started to land, or will start to land in the next week or so. Nominations for candidates closed last week. And with less than a month till polling day, we'll find out where will turn red and where might stay blue, or whether there are going to be any surprises.
Interesting stuff. Speaking of elections, these were held in the City of London on the 24th of March. 100 common councillors across 25 wards were up for election. Some key takeaways include 95 of those elected stood as independent candidates. We had 10 Labour candidates across the whole square mile. Only 5 of those were elected in Aldersgate and Cripplegate, 2 predominantly residential wards. There's 40 new members with 60 incumbents returned, and a number of long-standing members were not re-elected, including Jeremy Mayhew, Jamie Ingham Clark and Peter Bennett. So I think there's a feeling across the city at the moment that these elections represented an element of change within the cycle. And that's going to be particularly felt on the political leadership side of things, where we've got Catherine McGuinness, who's the chair of the Policy and Resources Committee, which is essentially the leader of the City Corporation. Yeah. And Alistair Moss, who's chair of the Planning and Transportation Committee, also stepping down after their 10 years leaders. It feels like a bit of a breath of fresh air at the moment at the city. Lots of new candidates, and let's see what happens.
Yeah, it's interesting with obviously, historically, most candidates are independent in the city and very rarely run on a political ticket. So it's interesting to see those 10 Labour candidates stand, obviously five of them get it. I mean, do you think that's the mark of a more political City of London going forward?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think it's a mark of an element of dissatisfaction within those wards. So they're predominantly residential wards to the north of the city, Aldersgate and Cripplegate. You've got the Barbican, the Golden Lane estate, and there's a feeling that residents up there aren't being heard, particularly when planning applications are going to consultation. And I feel like it's a definite tactic of Labour to field candidates within that part of the city. And it seems to have been a tactic that has worked. You know, they've got five Labour candidates elected, all standing on a residents first agenda.
Yeah, maybe that's something we can ask Chris about later on when we get to the interview.
Absolutely, I'm sure we will. And then just touching on some of the latest news stories to come out of the city, we saw an interesting report in Property Week, which noted that law firms are at the front of the queue for best-in-class offices, according to some new research from Knight Frank. So apparently law firms make up about 27% of all space taken in the City of London in 2021, and that represents about 12% of all take-up in central London, which is a significant figure, really.
Yeah, pretty sizable, and I suppose that maybe reflects the historic importance that law firms have put on office space as a way to attract the best talent globally.
Yeah,
but also obviously retain those high fee paying clients as well. But so the City of London will remain a legal powerhouse, I think is basically what that's saying.
I think that's right. The appetite's there for new office space, and the appetite's particularly there for law firms, which there's an interesting distinction as well, isn't there? You know, 98% of businesses within the square mile are SMEs.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's, again, a fascinating stat, which I don't think many people are aware of. So to see how the law firms interact with that is quite interesting. So in addition to that, we've got another couple of news stories. You know, Apple taking another three floors at 22 Bishopsgate, one of the City of London's newest skyscrapers, and the latest sign that the tech giant is very much committed to London as a whole, but particularly the city in Wandsworth, where it's got its HQ with Battersea Power Station, and now seemingly more and more floor space in the city.
Yep.
And then there's just some, you know, wider kind of news that Stanhope is looking to potentially buy 70 Grace Church Street, where the developer Tenacity received planning permission to redevelop the site. And then we've got others such as the Hong Kong-based Manhattan Garments Group completing an acquisition at 5 Fleet Place. So it seems that there's lots of activity at the moment going on in the city, lots of acquisitions, lots of planning permissions, and interesting to see how this is all going to play out in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, it feels pretty good at the moment, doesn't it, in the city in terms of compared to the dark days of the pandemic. I mean, our offices in the city, we're recording this from our office here near Moorgate, and definitely feels like it's getting busier, and this is the run up to Easter. So yeah, I think it's really nice to see everything coming back to life again.
And to talk about this and more, we have an interview with Chris Hayward, who's the Deputy Policy Chairman and also the former Chairman of the Planning and Transportation Committee. He's got a lot of insight into the city's built environment, and in particular, his vision for how the industry should be responding to some of the biggest topics up for discussion. So we'll be touching in on the recent City of London elections, consultation, the refurbishment versus redevelopment debate, and what lies in store for Bank.
Let's hear from him.
For this special edition podcast focusing on the City of London, I'm delighted to welcome Chris Hayward, Deputy Policy Chairman and former Chairman of the Planning and Transportation Committee. Chris, welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
So I suppose first things first, Chris, congratulations on your recent re-election on the 24th of March. How was campaigning, or is that just a distant memory now?
I would say it's not yet a distant memory. It's still very much with me, and I'm very relieved and grateful to the electorate for returning me to Guildhall. It was an interesting election, not least because we weren't sure just how high the turnout would be, mm-hmm. given COVID, how many people would be in the city to vote, what level of postal votes we would be able to achieve. But actually, we had just a few more voters registered than we had 5 years ago when we last went to the polls, because we've done a five-year term. And so, yeah, it was a great experience, but a huge relief, like all politicians say, to be re-elected.
Absolutely. And just out of interest, while you're on the campaign trail, was there anything in particular that stuck out to you? So perhaps some reoccurring comments or themes from members of the public, or just a different atmosphere with this being post-COVID, first election back?
I think there were some themes that came through during the election campaign. And one of them, of course, is here we are now in a post-COVID environment. The city is starting to come back. You know, we used to have 530,000 commuters coming into the city pre-COVID. We're probably back to about 60, 70% of that in a midweek. But of course, it's more hybrid working. So you've got a lot of people who are coming in on Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, but not on Mondays and Fridays. But people were interested in what's the long-term effect of work patterns going to be? Is it going to be hybrid working? There were questions, obviously, about, you know, we built a lot of high-rise blocks of offices in the city, and we're continuing, and all our forecasts tell us that's going to be the case. People were saying, well, will they get used? And if they will, can you explain why? And I think there's a genuine change in people's attitudes that nobody seems to believe that we'll go back to the old normal. There'll be a new normal, and really the question is, what's the new normal going to look like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've preempted a few of the themes that I think we're going to touch on in the podcast. But just before we get onto that, you know, you've been joined by two new members at the Broad Street Ward, which you represent. That's a theme that seems to have been replicated across the city. I think we've got 40% of those elected will be first-time members. So in your mind, do you see this as a bit of a change election in the city?
I really do. I think it's a sea change election. I think for a start, we've got 38 new members, 62 old members returned. And what's interesting is the demographic of those new members. There's been a real shift in emphasis. For years, this tended to be a place where people of an older age group or even retired tended to take up and stand for election. This is a really breath of fresh air. It's a new demographic, a new and very exciting and very welcome change, in my view, to the City Corporation's membership.
And has that been a conscious effort by the City Corporation to install that, or has this kind of just happened by accident with changing demographics in the city?
No, actually, we went out with a very purposeful message under the slogan of Speak for the City. And our idea was to try to attract more people, more diversity, younger people. And so we went out there specifically with that message of get engaged, get involved. And we hired an elections engagement manager, something we'd never done before, and which is now going to be a permanent post within the corporation in order that we can continue on this trajectory. You know, the last two elections, I thought we only had 25 new members each time. So the fact that we've gone up to 34 new members is a really interesting and exciting change.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, I think most listeners will agree with that. It feels like a breath of fresh air. And with those new members, I suppose, comes a changing culture in the city and a changing focus on different work streams. Just touching on the City Corporation's work, the draft city plan. I mean, that's the local plan which sets out the vision, strategies and objectives for planning. It's been paused to undertake some further evidence gathering to ensure that it provides a robust framework for the city in a post-COVID world. What sort of changes are we going to be expecting? Are there going to be some significant shifts in policy direction, or is it going to be more or less the same?
Look, I think we want a very dynamic local plan. That's always been our aspiration. And I think it was wise, given COVID, to stop, pause and reflect on what it should look like. Now, I can't tell you what the ultimate plan will be, but what I can tell you is that I don't think it'll be radically different to the first draft that we had agreed, in the sense that all our evidence suggests, our forecasts suggest, that the demand for office space will continue despite the change in working patterns. And that's because people will want to be more spread out. They'll use office space in a different way. There will be more co-working spaces and less rigidity of desks and tables and long rows of people working in the days they did in the city. So I think that will continue on. We are, and I have to say this, primarily a business city, and I've said it many times, we only have 8,000 or so residents in the city, but as I said to you earlier, it was 500,000 a day of commuters. But I think we also want to make sure that we develop other aspects of the city. So our cultural life in the city is becoming hugely important, and we're making huge investments in the new Museum of London and indeed with the major refurbishment of the Barbican Centre, so that the plan will look different, it'll feel different. I think it'll feel more modern and it'll feel more dynamic, and that's what we want to aim for it to be.
Fantastic. I mean, that slightly preempts my next question, which was about what the opportunities are. But by the sounds of it, it's, you know, more office space, creating a more dynamic city, more to offer than just a place to come and work. The point that you made about increased office space is an interesting one, because when we go out to consultation, particularly around the key residential areas of the city, I'm thinking to the north where the Barbican and the Golden Lane estate is, one of the common responses we get from a lot of residents is, why are you building more office space? Aren't people working from home now? is this something that the city should be prioritising? I mean, what's your response to those residents?
So let me be clear. You know, with our office spaces, there would be no point whatsoever in converting those into residential accommodation. And I'll tell you why. It's simply this, that our biggest challenge from a housing perspective in the City of London is affordable housing for young professional workers in the city. And if we convert these very expensive towers into residential accommodation, first of all, they will not be affordable residential accommodation. They'll be snapped up by overseas buyers, probably lie empty for most of the year. And actually, that is not the sort of vibrancy that we want to create in the city. So actually, I look at things the other way around. I think what we need to do is to grow the city more as a 24/7 city and destination. So our nighttime economy has already improved dramatically. More wine bars, more restaurants. And the changing demographic of the younger office worker in the city wants to work and play in the same place. So, you know, it wasn't so many years ago that at 7 o'clock at night, the city went dead. You either went home or you went to the West End if you wanted to socialise. Yeah. Today, we want this to be the place where people spend their money. And so we will look to build an infrastructure around the offices that will actually cater for that more discerning young office worker.
Fantastic. Just touching on office space, you know, the latest draft of the new local plan, which was released last year, sets out a target for about 2 million square metres of an additional office floor space between 2016 and 2036. What, in your mind, is the most sustainable way to achieve that?
Well, I think you choose a very interesting word there, sustainable, because that is going to be fundamental importance to us as we continue our development programme around offices. You know, do we refurbish or do we pull down old buildings and rebuild? And I think the answer there is that we have to refurbish because we've got a very, wherever we can, because we've got a very ambitious climate action strategy. By 2027, we want to be absolutely hitting our first targets. By 2040, we want the whole 3 billion of our property investment to be net zero. And so wherever we can, we want to refurbish. So what that says to me is that the quality of developments that are coming through from planners and from architects and from developers have got to demonstrate, first of all, that the buildings can't be refurbished because we've got this zero carbon target to meet. Or if they can't be, then they've got to be really sustainably built, sustainably designed. That's going to play, you know, I think over the next 5 years, that's going to play a fundamental part of our development thinking. And the planning committee is already looking at that. Every time we look at an application now, sustainability, which is something we never used to consider in the old days, is a forefront of all our deliberations.
So sustainability is going to be at the forefront of any new city going forward.
It is.
And refurbish wherever we can. That seems to be the motto going forward.
Wherever possible.
And you're talking about, you know, if you can't refurbish, then we have a redevelopment, but the redevelopment has to be of the highest quality sustainability. I mean, do you have any examples, recent examples, that you think particularly highlight that issue quite well?
Yeah, so let me say this, that I think that the new office world in the city, where they're going to do well will be what I call the top end, the grade one quality, grade A quality office buildings. I do think those older buildings, particularly those actually out in some of the boroughs, are going to struggle much more to actually get occupancy. And if I tell you, for example, the 22 Bishopsgate has been probably one of the most sustainable, as before it was Bloomberg's new offices, buildings in the city. They are both classic examples, one low rise and one high rise, of buildings where where sustainability was at the very forefront of everything we did there. In fact, you could almost have imagined that they knew that COVID was coming, because they actually are the post-COVID buildings, even though they were given planning consent long before we knew COVID was ever going to hit us. So I think 22 Bishopsgate's a good example, you know, 72 floors high. And it's no longer an office building. It's a community. You know, you go in there, it's not just about, you know, the catering. It's about the fact it's got its own hospital. It's got its own doctor's practice. It's got its own shops. These places are now communities, you know, the quality of life. You know, you've got wellness. You've got yoga. You've got all these things happening now in the modern office space. It's a totally different concept to when I first started doing planning in this city a decade ago.
Yeah, and I think it's testament to 22 Bishopsgate that Apple's just taken another couple of floors there. I mean, they're 8 floors currently, aren't they?
They are, and they've taken another 3 floors. And when you get an organisation like Apple doing that, you know you're doing something right.
Yeah, I mean, you've made some really interesting points there. I suppose something that I just want to draw out a little bit more is, again, a comment that we hear a lot during consultation is that there's an inherent contradiction between redevelopment and sustainability, that the corporation will have to prioritise one over the other. Do you see it that way, or do you see actually that there's a balancing act to be played here when applications are going towards committee?
Look, I see the latter. I think there's a balancing act that has to be played between sustainability and redevelopment. I don't think it's an absolute either-or, because every application has to be judged on its individual merits, and that's what, in respect to planning policy, and that's what the Planning Committee seeks to do with all the big applications that come before us. So I think it's a balance, and you have to consider both of these issues in your approach to the new city.
What guidance are we to expect from the City Corporation, and what also do you expect from developers when looking at new sites in the city?
Okay, so that's a good question. I think what I have to say to you at the moment is there's no set metric, but we are working to develop guidance on what information developers need to provide so that the Planning and Transportation Committee can make informed decisions on the carbon impact of buildings. The carbon impact of buildings is the key aspect that we're looking for. And what we will do is we will consult on this guidance in the first half of this year.
Okay, fantastic. So we'll look out for that and publicise it to all of our clients and members listening in. The 24/7 city, which I know is a big ambition of yours and sits within the local plan, you know, we've been talking about a lot of probably seen as less conventional uses within the city: residential, student, co-living, hotels. Is there anything out of that that you particularly want to draw out with future applications, or do you think actually them all coming together in a manner that complements each other, that's what the priority is for the city going forward?
Look, I think we've done really well with things like hotels. Yeah. I think there are other areas which we still need to grow in. For example, exhibition space. I'd still like to see us have some really high quality exhibition space in the city. I think we must also remember that although we have this business city, we still do have 8,000 residents, and I don't want the residents to feel forgotten in all of this. They live in the city, they choose to live in the city, they get, in my view, a first-class amenities, they get first-class local government services, and we want to make sure that the residents also feel engaged and involved in what we're doing in planning. It shouldn't be a them and us, it should be understanding. We won't always agree on every planning application, but we've got to work with our residents as well as with our businesses in bringing the new city forward.
Well, I'm really glad you raised that, because that's a perfect segue into my next section. So going back to the local elections, we've got 5 Labour councillors elected up in Cripplegate and Aldersgate, 2 very residential areas of the city. A key part of a lot of those Labour candidates' platforms was standing up for residents, particularly in the context of developments and consultation. What's your view on this? Do you think residents within those areas are consulted on properly?
Look, I think we do our very best with consultation. We go through all the statutory measures we need to, and a lot of non-statutory measures, I might add, as well. Can we do better? Yes, of course. We can always do better. And I am aware that there was disquiet amongst some of our residents, and there has been, and I'm conscious of wanting to see that addressed in this new court. So it is about listening, it is about explaining, it is about communicating with our residents and trying to explain why we're doing what we're doing, which incidentally does have benefits for them as well. And I don't want them to feel that they're not being consulted. So I personally can say that I will do everything I can. I'm the guest speaker at the Barbicans Association's annual general meeting.
Fantastic.
And some have said to me, isn't that like Daniel walking into the lion's den? And I say, no, it's not. It's about going to see a very important part of our electorate who will no doubt have a lot of messages they want to share with me. And I will do my best to explain our position to them as well. So let's try and work as partners. Let's try and all pull together for the greater good of the city that we all love.
Absolutely. And I think over the past few years, consultation's really taken a much more central stage with the City Corporation and particularly the Planning and Transportation Committee. Westminster City Council have just recently published an early engagement guidance, and obviously the city never liking to be outdone by Westminster. Are there any updates to the statement of community involvement in the city?
Well, I'm really glad you asked me that, because actually there are. It's due to be renewed later this year. I'm pleased to be able to tell you that. And it's good to know that Westminster have been doing the same thing. I mean, we're not competitive with Westminster, but I always like to think that we lead where Westminster follow. Of course there is. The answer is yes. And so that should be good news as far as our residents are concerned.
fantastic. I mean, there's always a healthy rivalry between Westminster and
always. The City. We love them and they love us.
Absolutely. And I, just talking about Westminster, I remember when I was at the City and Westminster Property Associations, and during that time, you were actually chairman of the Planning and Transportation Committee. And I actually remember you remarking at one of our seminars that you wanted to transform Bank into a European-style piazza where people would be able to go and experience a coffee, drinks, food. And you always had these very grand visions for how you wanted to see the city. I mean, do you hold similar visions for Bank and the wider city in the coming years?
Well, personally speaking, yes, I do. We have a very imaginative and exciting scheme called All Change at Bank. You'll remember that when I was chairman of Planning and Transportation, the scheme then was about Bank on safety, because we were having to deal with the difficulty of the five tributary roads all converging on the one junction. I think we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to turn Bank into something which is at the very centre of the city, which really radiates air quality, which radiates a fabulous environment for people to go, whether they be office workers or residents. So I'm as passionate as I was then about creating that and seeking to create that. I think we have got that opportunity, and I think we should do that. And I think we've managed to show over those years that actually, of course, nobody likes change. Of course, people are fearful of it, but we've been able to make it work. And I think the next stage will be even more exciting.
So do you see Bank as a catalyst for change for the city?
I've always seen Bank as the catalyst for change, because it is at the very heart geographically of our city. And therefore, it has an opportunity with the historic buildings around it, whether it's Mansion House, the Royal Exchange, Bank of England, to really create something which is, frankly, probably the best in the world. You know, we always talk about the city being unique because it's a Roman city and it's a place where, you know, you can build a tall office building right next door to a Christopher Wren church. And I think the piazza feel of the Bank will be the next stage in what's that very exciting jigsaw that keeps our unique identity and keeps us as the global capital of the world.
Fantastic. So, Chris, thanks very much for your input today. I think it's been some really genuine insight, and I hope all the listeners have found that really useful. Quite a fun way that we like to end these sometimes is with a quick fire round. So I'll give you about six questions, and if you could just let me know in a word what your answer is, that would be fantastic. So question one, work from home or work in the office?
I think the answer is probably both, hybrid. I'm hedging my bets there. But if I had to come down on one side or the other, I'd say come and work in the office, because it's a great place. It's a great environment. You'll get to meet all your colleagues. You'll be able to socialise with them and work with them. And I want to see you all back in our city. So if you ask me to come down on one side or the other, it's the office.
Agreed. And come and work in an office in the city. Question two, Barbican Centre or One New Change?
Barbican Centre, because we own it. It's probably one of the finest cultural institutions in the world. So why not come and experience the fabulous, fabulous entertainment that's offered at the Barbican, owned by the City of London Corporation.
Good plug there. Redevelopment or refurbishment?
I think, as I tried to say earlier in my messaging to you, refurbishment's the ideal, but we recognise it's not always possible. So where it's not possible, and where it's demonstrably not possible, then it has to be redevelopment. So obviously we want a preference for refurbishment because of our climate action strategy. But where that's not possible, obviously we're going to have to look for redevelopment.
Leadenhall Market or Spitalfields Market?
Well, you know, we own them both, so this is a trickier one. And what I would say to you, though, is if you've ever been to Leadenhall Market, you'll know the unique atmosphere that market has. It is a fabulous place, both to shop and to enjoy entertainment, the bars, the restaurants. The vibrancy of Leadenhall Market is one of the most exciting spots that I enjoy going to in our square mile. So it has to be Leadenhall Market.
I agree. Fantastic for an after-work pint. And then final one for me, the gherkin or cheese grater?
Now, you see, I would have said, of course, but you didn't include it, the tulip. But unfortunately, the government didn't allow us to build the tulip. For me, I think it's the gherkin, because the gherkin was really, after Tower 42, was really the first tall building that we really constructed in the square mile. It's a pretty small building, actually, now. But it holds a special affectionate place in my heart, A, because it was that first tall building, and B, because it could have been the site of the tulip as well, which it's now sadly not going to be.
Fantastic. Who knows, maybe the tulip will regrow in the future.
That would be amazing. I would love that.
Chris, fantastic. Thanks for your insight, and you've been a great guest.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks for listening to another episode of Polls Apart. We hope you have a fantastic long weekend over Easter. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a pre-London elections episode with just a week to go before the polls. And don't forget, if you enjoy our podcast, to like and subscribe by searching Polls Apart on all your usual podcast platforms. So thanks very much. Speak to you all soon. Bye, 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 bye.